Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
There's a nice saying that when the global crisis hit in 2008-2009 and the private banks were reducing lending, as you know they do during times of crisis to protect their returns, their profits, the public banks in Turkey was increasing lending, and the head of the bank said, well, when it's raining, you don't put away your umbrella, saying, we have this capacity, and we're in a time of trouble, let's use it. And that by no means was restricted to Turkey. The German public banks did that. The Brazilian public banks did that. I'm sure the Bank of North Dakota did that. Pretty much any public bank around the world during the global financial crisis, most costly crisis in the history of humanity, brought onto us by private banks, basically took out their umbrella and used it during that crisis.
That's our guest today, a renowned global expert on publicly owned banks, Thomas Marwa, talking about the resilience of public banks around the world and the contrast they present against the backdrop of the private banking regime that we all live with. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. As you may know, our focus on public banking represents a departure from the economic orthodoxy of neoliberal market-driven principles in that there's a sense that the rights and interests of citizens should matter as much or more than the profits that can be derived from any given business model, including banking. This focus is being brought into increasingly bright light by a variety of environmental and marketplace pressures, from the aspirations of the Green New Deal to the growing debt of virtually every one of our fellow citizens and our local and state governments. So we're pleased to be able to talk about how public banks are faring elsewhere in the world and what the nature of these banks are, particularly around their governance and management. One of the recurring questions we hear from every part of the country when we introduce folks to public banking is how we realistically intend to keep the political and special interests out of the cookie jar of a public bank's lending portfolio. Well, Thomas provides key insights into that by emphasizing the role of protecting public interests in bank management through vital and vibrant public participation with bank operations. Today's discussion with Thomas Marwa is the first segment of a two-part series with him. Later in the program, we'll hear the third installment of our interview about the history and beginnings of the Bank of North Dakota, the only publicly owned bank in the United States at this time. We'll be talking once again with the author of the official BND centenary book, Mike Jacobs. The bank is now officially 100 years old, and what they had to go through to get it this far is an interesting and educational tale of public will, political intrigue, and personality conflicts. Well, thankfully, Ellen continues her prodigious writing practice and has brought a new article to the fore that describes yet another way in which private banking institutions receive extremely sweet treatment from the Fed, which pays them many times the amount of interest that we receive when they park their funds overnight in the Fed's digital vault, and how they shut out others who would like the same treatment.
What prompted me to write this article was I saw that the interest rate that the Federal Reserve is paying on excess reserves to the banks is 2.4%. And what are the excess reserves? Those are basically the deposits of the banks. Banks bank at the Federal Reserve, and we bank at these banks that actually create our money in the form of loans. So for the banks, the Federal Reserve creates the money, and they get to store their money at the Fed, which is totally safe. It can't go bankrupt, and they're getting 2.4% on their reserves, which includes our deposits. I mean, that's where they park our deposits if they're not using them for liquidity to back their loans. And we, meanwhile, are getting on average 0.1%. So they're getting 24 times what we're getting on average. And if you're at Bank of America, for example, you're getting 0.01%. So they're getting 240 times what you're getting at Bank of America. This system squeezes out everybody that's got more than $250,000 to invest. So these are the big investors, like the pension funds, which is our money, or the money market funds, and actually it would include government funds, but then they are covered supposedly by collateral. But anyway, because of this system where the only reason we even get deposit insurance is that in the 1930s, the Federal Reserve, instead of supporting the public banking system, which they had at that time, which was very good, the postal banking system. I mean, we think postal banking like it's something different, but really postal banking was just a public banking system. It was a system where the public could put their money, earn a little interest. They were getting 2% at that time. And they did small transfers. I mean, you couldn't get a big loan, but that was another thing. They were blocked from getting big loans. They were blocked from raising their interest rates. And the government in the 1930s, rather than bolstering this public system that could have been very extensive and made big loans like private banks do, they bolstered the private system by guaranteeing their deposits. But there was a lot of push to guarantee the deposits, actually, from the populace themselves. And so the government said, well, okay, but we're not going over 100,000. That's what the limit was at that time. So that meant all the big depositors didn't have a safe place to put their money. So what they do now is they put it in the repo market, which is safe enough for them. But for us, the repo market is the thing that crashed in 2008. It was a run on the repo market. So the repo market is like a pawn shop where the depositor gives, let's say, typically the bank gives the bank its money, like say a pension fund, and then in return they get some sort of asset, but they swap it back in the morning. So every day you roll over this one-day loan. So anytime that the depositor wants to, they can pull the money out, just like as if it were a regular deposit account. It's good by the day. But on the basis of that, banks are making these long-term loans, and that's what Lehman Brothers was doing, for example, at something like 33 to 1. And so it was very risky. And when lenders or, you know, the repo, they're technically it's a sale and repossession, but it's really just a securitized loan. So when the lenders got nervous, they all pulled their money out at once. And here was Lehman Brothers with all these loans outstanding, and they no longer had the money to back them. So that's what tipped the scales and, you know, tipped the whole thing over. The dominoes went down globally due to this very risky system. So you could, in theory, have a system where everybody gets to bank at the central bank, and that's actually been discussed. Now, interestingly, it's been, we talked about this before, but some academics and some government officials from the Fed and from the Treasury have discussed the possibility of opening up the Fed's deposit window to everyone, which would be very secure. You'd eliminate runs. But the problem is, the reason they don't do it is that then the banks wouldn't have any liquidity to base their loans on. So the banks wouldn't be able to make loans. But you could, arguably, let this public system also make big loans. And then the objection would be, well, that's too much for the Federal Reserve to handle. But we're not talking about the Federal Reserve handling it. We're just talking about the Federal Reserve being the deep pocket. You know, they're like the backup. And then the system itself, we've got post offices everywhere in the country. You don't have to build new banks. They're there already. You just open a teller window in the post office, which is what they used to do. And we could set up for big loans, like for business, you could set up a network of public bank, which is what we've been talking about, a network of public banks. I mean, that's also the solution I'm proposing in this book that I've just finished that should be out soon, called Banking on the People. So there I go into more detail. So hopefully, you know, you can go step by step and you can see what I'm talking about. But anyway, the point is that we could have had a big public system. The public system, the postal banking system, was inaugurated in 1911, and the Federal Reserve was not set up until 1913. So it actually predates the postal system. The big banks immediately targeted it and tried to take it down, and they've been trying to take it down ever since. They've been trying to take down the post office, which we saw like in 2006, where they passed that rule where you have to have medical insurance 75 years into the future. You know, outrageous. I mean, it's clearly designed to cripple the post office. But in other countries, the public systems have been around a lot longer. There's not so much opposition to them. There's not so much opposition to the notion of, oh, this is socialist because the government owns it. In fact, you want the government to own many things. That it allows for fuller accountability. It's safer. You've got more resources. So.
And the trend is global. Here in the U.S., of course, the Green New Deal is bringing the public banking idea forward, as well as the postal banking prospect, putting it on a different set of tracks because it has the support of the unions, as well as inner-city social and economic justice stakeholders. So there's a lot of movement back toward the idea that public utility should be owned by the public, not the private sector. And of course, in the UK, where we see Labour rising on the electoral horizon, one of the first things they would do is nationalise the railways, the postal systems, and all of the things that Maggie Thatcher moved out of public hands to privatise, or as we like to say, profitise a public functionality. So more articles, Ellen, more articles, please.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I did get some pushback on that it was a bit too wonky, too complicated. But it is a complicated subject. That's why I write, to try to unwonkize it, you know, because people shy away from it and they think, well, it's too complicated, so I'll just leave it for the experts. They know what they're talking about. But nowadays, we know they don't know what they're talking about. They have failed, and we don't trust them. So we want to know what's going on. But most people don't have time to pick through all this stuff, which is kind of boring.
Yeah.
So that's why I like to try to clarify stuff.
Well, we all have our special interests, Ellen. We're just really glad you have yours. All right. Well, thanks, Ellen. We'll get on with our interview.
Okay. Thank you. I'm speaking today with Thomas Marois, a senior lecturer in the Department of Development Studies, or SOAS, at the University of London, and the author of a number of books and papers, including one called Toward a Green Public Bank in the Public Interest, which he did for the UN Research Institute for Social Development last year. So that's something a topic of particular interest right now in the U.S. with our Green New Deal discussions going on. So it's great to be talking to you again, Tom.
Great to be talking with you, too. Thank you.
So you've written quite a bit lately about public banking globally. We just have one bank, the Bank of North Dakota, so that's the one model that we're always writing about here. But it's not the only model, and you've got extensive knowledge on the other possibilities. So I wondered if you could, the extent of public banking globally and sort of the range and what their assets are and how well they're doing relative to private banks.
Sure, I can try, because contrary to what most people think, and I guess maybe the sort of common sense of what people think about public banks, is that, you know, most of them are gone, or they're not really in existence, or what's left is not really all that important. But it's quite a different story, actually, in truth. There are a number of public banks, you know, depending on exactly how you measure it, but if you're looking at public banks that are dominant, owned by a government or some kind of public authority, there are still nearly 700 around the world. And that's in every corner of the world, the global north, the global south, East Asia, Africa, South America, and of course all over Europe, pretty much anywhere you look. And they've got incredible amounts of resources under their control. And so today there's sort of a resurgence, if you will, in interest in public banks, and particularly around the green finance agenda, the transition to a green economy and the sustainable development goals, et cetera, et cetera. But quite often the World Bank or commentators, you know, sort of looking at the question of how to finance this green transition will say, you know, we have somewhere in the range of $2, maybe $3 or $4 trillion worth of assets in the public banks, and we should use that to help finance this green transition. But again, you know, there's these 700 banks, and they have assets more 10 times that, close to $40 trillion in assets, still under dominant public control today. That's close to, I think, 47 or 48% of global GDP. And that's just public banks and bank-like institutions. That's excluding central banks, excluding the even the large multilateral banks like the World Bank, Asian Development Bank, et cetera. So these are, you know, by and large, national, relatively local, between national and local and municipal level banks that have, you know, trillions of dollars in assets, and they're everywhere. And unfortunately, we're sort of under the assumption that they don't really exist anymore. And it's an important realization to keep in mind that there's this much capacity, financial assets, financial power that is potentially within the grasp of normal citizens and governments.
And there are actually some new ones that have come online since 2008, right? I think other countries are, we have so much resistance to the whole idea. I mean, we have a booming, thriving public banking movement. We're pushing ahead, and there's more and more awareness that that's even a possibility here. But the bent of the natural inclination of people and economists is to say, to be very leery of government owning anything or running anything as if government itself would be running the bank, which is, we know it's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about bankers running the bank. But can you say something about like the, just the difference in sort of attitude, or how do they manage to get theirs going? Why has it thrived elsewhere and not so much here?
It's a really big question, really important question. I think it's sort of irony is that quite often in countries with still existing substantial, powerful public banks that are quite active may or may not appreciate it that much. I don't know the exact reason, but it might be, you know, quite often because they're, you know, they're working fairly well, that they don't sort of raise that high on the national radar. But the point is, you know, going back into the late 1800s and early 1900s, public banks and forms of national development banks have formed part of national development strategies around the world. And they were always considered a legitimate, a credible, you know, financing option. And it's only recently, really with the sort of rise of neoliberalism and the dominance of neoclassical economics, that deep set resistance to public banks has set in. But you can look at the most popular example right now, which is the KfW in Germany. And its history goes back to, and as you know, and I'm sure you're aware, and probably many of the people listening to the show, goes back to the end of the Second World War and a decision at that time to create a bank to invest the Marshall Funds that were coming for reconstruction and development in Europe in, and put it in this bank called the KfW. And then, you know, that bank essentially served the German public and was representative as well, you know, quite an integrated tool of national development, even international development in the German case. And so they're run by bankers and they're run by professionals. But I think it is an important thing to keep in mind that there isn't, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and in many of the examples of public banks around the world, it isn't necessarily a bad thing that the bank is connected to government and has its governing boards in particular have ministers of government on it. But also, and this is probably a more important thing in terms of the question of governance, and I would say a vital question in the case of the U.S., is who else is on that board? Because it's the board of governors that really sets the overall tone for the public bank, gives it its mandate, its mission, but it also absorbs representation from society, or it should be absorbing representation for society. And banks like the KfW can, in fact, be quite democratic, having both government representation in terms of the Ministry of the Economy and Ministry for Development. I can't remember the exact names of the ministries offhand, but there's two ministries that sit as rotating chairs of the board. But then there are 37 other members from different parts of German society that sit on there and in a sense hold the bank accountable. that's, you know, a fairly representative board. The State Bank of India, for example, which is another, that bank was nationalized in 1955 and became the State Bank of India as part of India's developmental policy. But it too holds, has both government representatives on the board, as well as other representatives from the bank workers union, from employers unions, from different sectors of the economy, agriculture, etc., that inform the missions of the bank. And it's important. So when I talk about the public interest, public banks in the public interest, I see that as only possible in public banks that have some sort of substantive form of representation on them. And unfortunately, neoclassic economics and neoliberals have vilified that and made the sense that if there's any connection to the public interest or to government or to society, that bank is then politicized. And then if it's politicized, it's necessarily going to be inefficient and be corrupt and all these sorts of things. But there's actually, you know, there's no necessary connection there at all, mm-hmm. between that.
Yeah.
You can have better and worse run banks, and it depends on the level of democratization.
Yeah, I think that is the distinguishing factor. People think of, they immediately think of politicians they don't like, and they think you want to give X or Y a bank, you know, to exploit for his own purposes. But that's not what we're talking about. So an important thing mm-hmm. is to have proper oversight by local people. And that's another thing. It's a big issue here right now, how to set up standards for governance for these public banks. And sometimes you get groups that sometimes they want to say, well, the bank can't invest in this, that, and the other, can't invest in oil companies or something like that. But it seems to me it depends on your local community. Some local communities actually thrive on coal, for example, and maybe they don't want to say you can't invest in coal. But you need a representative governing body from that particular community and whatever that community thinks is in its interest.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think norms are important here. And I think my normative output is that I think that's the only way you can really substantively, democratically govern a bank is by meaningfully finding ways to include local oversight, local representation, and not just in terms of, you know, holding a conference now and again and drawing in pillars of the community to give feedback, but to actually build those representatives from your community into the actual governance and ruling of that bank in ways that are binding and legally binding and committed so that the community actually has control over the bank, and then therefore ensuring at the same time that representation is itself representative of the community. There's another example I really like to point to. It would be another one you're also familiar with, and that's the Banco Popular of Costa Rica.
I've written about that. That's a great model. Go ahead.
Yeah, so just to, you know, remind your listeners that, and my opinion on that bank is that it's the world's most democratic bank, bar none. It was set up in 1969, formally, and it's owned and controlled by the workers of Costa Rica. And it has what's called the workers' assembly of working women, working men's assembly of the bank, which has 290 representatives from across, I believe, 10 or 11 different social sectors. So teachers, artisans, labor unions, SMEs, community associations, etc., from across Costa Rica. That sit on that board and are elected to that board one way or another. And then that workers' assembly in turn nominates four of the seven members of the governing board of the bank itself, and three governments. So there's three and four representatives, three from the government, four from the workers' assembly, that then, you know, are charged more with the day-to-day operations and guidance of the bank. And then cutting across that, they have instituted very progressive gender mandates as well, to the extent that the board has to be 50% women on a rotating basis. Right now, there are four women on the national board, the seven representatives, as well as 50% within the 290-member workers' assembly. And they also have the permanent women's committee built into the structure of the bank itself. And so gender forms quite significantly within the governance of the of that bank itself. And so you see, you know, this important way in which, you know, you build in not only representation of sectors, but representation of men and women into the bank in ways that are equitable. So it's quite, for me, it's quite an inspiring example. It's not perfect. There's no bank, public or private, in this world that is perfect. But I think there is, you know, this question of oversight and democratization of public banks and how you need to instill that in its very structures, if you want it to be an alternative, is very, very important. And if you don't want it to just be a public bank in name, but not a public bank insofar as it represents the public interest, like, you know, banks that are nationalized in the UK, the RBS, and so on, it's owned by the government, but there's absolutely no connection at all to society at this moment in terms of how that bank is run. It's been firewalled very much along the lines where we started, you know, this notion that if politicians or the public has control of a bank, then they'll use it and abuse it. And so they opted, when they bailed out that huge failed private bank, to firewall it and keep it away from what's neoclassical economics would call it, the grabbing hand of government. But, you know, it could be otherwise. And there's still a lot of movement in the UK and within Europe around a lot of these banks that were bailed out in the 2008-2009 crisis to reclaim them, these nationalized banks, and do something with them in the public interest.
I saw where Labour, if they get in, that they would keep the RBS as a public institution. But can you explain more about the firewall? Like, how does that work? How do they manage to keep the public out?
Now that I brought it up and you've questioned me on it, I can't remember the exact specifications of it. Like, I couldn't tell you the membership of the board. But what has happened is that they've essentially set up a coordinating committee that is responsible for governing the RBS, the Royal Bank of Scotland. And so there's no direct government input and there's no direct public representation on the board. It's simply, once they bailed out the bank, they then created this oversight committee, if you will, of independent board members to ensure that the bank returns to profitability along market lines, so trying to maximize profit as fast as possible, with the government's interest being trying to get back its own initial investment. But there is quite a bit of movement within the European civil society and NGO circles to, in cases like RBS, but also in other cases in Netherlands and in Belgium, for example, as well, Belfus Bank, there's quite a bottom-up push from civil society, essentially, say, you know, we bailed out, effectively bought these private banks. They are public, but they're not being run in the public interest. And given the substantial challenges that society faces now in terms of trying to what I like to call decarbonize the economy, trying to push forward with green transition and find ways to fund that quickly and equitably. And on the other hand, we have a global economy that is highly hyper-financialized, and so we need ways and institutions that can, in a sense, try to help de-financialize the economy. And so the civil society is pointing to these huge problems of carbon and financial instability and saying, listen, we've got these public banks in fact under government control. Let's use them to and mobilize them to work on these problems of transition to a low carbon economy and transition to a more de-financialized, more stable financial system. And that's growing movement within Europe on that. And then in terms of the Labour's platform, if and when it, you know, it should come to power, then yeah, the idea would be there's notions there of maintaining the RBS, but also, you know, developing a range of other local public banks and development banks to push forward with, you know, something like what you're talking about in the U.S. around some sort of a new green deal, or basically revitalizing and stimulating local economies around the UK.
I guess we should probably define public bank. And what's the difference between a public bank and a public development bank? Like, where do they get their money?
Okay. Well, I mean, it will vary hugely. A few different names in terms of public banks. So you can talk about a public commercial or a public retail bank, and that's a bank that is publicly owned, you know, more than 50% owned, has some kind of a public mandate and is connected to the government in one way or another. And it will take deposits. So it would be like a Citibank or, you know, something like that, where you could go in, take out an account, have a savings account, use it for checking, have credit cards and all sorts of things like that. So that's what we consider a commercial or retail bank, and it can be publicly owned. A public development bank usually will not be engaged on one-on-one level with customers, won't have things like credit cards or savings accounts. Typically, you can't get a normal like house mortgage or something like that. And they'll have far fewer branches. But they are focused on, as the name suggests, projects of development. So funding infrastructure, funding small, medium-sized enterprises, working with quite a large scale with other public authorities, the government, other things like electrical provisioning, transportation, healthcare, schools, education, and so on, and funding basically essential public services. And they'll do that on a sort of more institutional level. And then they can also develop, the public development banks will also quite often work in close collaboration with the more retail or commercial type banks. So they could set out special loans, for example, as they have done in Germany, where they would give preferential sort of home loans to people who are trying to set up solar energy panels on their houses. So they would work with local banks, whether it's a private or a public or a cooperative bank like the Sparkhausen in Germany, to hand those out to individual customers and then work through those local branches, commercial public banks, at a more sort of second level, institutional level. And their sources of money, it'll vary quite a bit. Initially, the money would inevitably come from governments, so there'd be a government capital stake in it. And then over time, they can use their own earnings to build up their own sources of capital. But then they can also, one of the specialties of development banks is that drawing on public guarantees or sovereign guarantees from the government, they can access market funds internationally or nationally or internationally from other banks, from financial markets. And typically, more so for the global north, places like the United States or UK or Germany can access global financial markets at quite cheap interest rates. In the global south, it's more difficult there because quite often a development bank's credit rating, we tie to a country-level credit rating. So a development bank in Central America, for example, will not be able to access international financial markets at the same rates as a new development bank in the United States would be able to. And then the idea is that these development banks, whatever their rate of interest, passes that on to their customers and should offer some sort of preferential interest rate and terms, as well as, importantly, technical expertise. So quite often, development banks will have their own experts on, of course, on financing, but also in terms of agricultural development or infrastructure or electrical provisioning or in terms of supporting SMEs. So it's a very important, they can also be a very important source of knowledge and technical knowledge. And that sort of extends to wherever you see these kinds of development banks around the world. And but there's a third important type of public bank that should also be known. We call them universal banks, and they are more particular to the global south. So places through much of Latin America, you'll find them, as well as East Asia. Pretty much anywhere. And we call them universal banks. And these universal public banks combine the commercial, the retail, like the deposit taking, the checking, the day-to-day interactions with customers on your street corner, your local branch, with development banking functions. So they will also be supporting infrastructure. They'll also be supporting SMEs or, in many cases, agricultural. So one example like that is in Turkey. They have a bank. It's called the Halk Bank, H-A-L-K. And it goes back, it was formed back in 1932, if I'm not mistaken, or 1933. And it's a universal bank, so you can go and open an account there. But it focuses on funding small, medium-sized enterprises. And in Turkey, that's particularly important because 99% of employment is through SMEs, through small, medium-sized enterprises. And this the Hulk Bank in particular focuses and has a lot of in-house capacity and specialization around this community. So its source of funding, it comes from people having their daily deposits in the bank, and then the bank can use those deposits as a source of capital, like in any bank, but it lends out both to individuals, but also then to institutions, to organizations, SMEs, and so on. And should there be a specific program that the government wants to promote local development or develop in a particular region, they can then funnel those funds through this bank to a specific community or sector in the economy, like SME. So there's these three types of banks.
Is Hulk Bank, is it quite successful? Like, it's profitable?
Well, successful in the case that it has persisted for nearly 90 years now. It's a relatively stable bank. It turns a generous return, or earns a generous return for the government year in and year out, earning as much or more than private banks. And it provides services throughout the country to communities, and particularly to the small, medium-sized enterprise sector of the economy. And particularly at times of crisis, that bank has sort of stepped up its lending for its customers at that time. There's a nice saying that when the global crisis hit in 2008-2009 and the private banks were reducing lending, as you know they do during times of crisis, to protect their returns, their profits, the public banks in Turkey, including this Halk Bank, People's Bank, was increasing lending. And the CEO or the head of the bank said, well, when it's raining, you don't put away your umbrella, saying basically, you know, we have this resource, we have this capacity, and we're in a time of trouble, let's use it. And that is something by no means was restricted to Turkey. The German public banks did that, the Brazilian public banks did that, I'm sure the Bank of North Dakota did that, if I remember reading some of your work on
right.
it. Pretty much any public bank around the world went, and during the, you know, the global financial crisis, most costly crisis in the history of humanity, brought onto us by private banks, you know, basically took out their umbrella and used it during that crisis.
I had written about the public banks of the global south, Latin America and so forth, and how well they were doing, the development banks, right after 2008. But now those countries all seem to be not doing so well. What do you attribute that to? Is it like Venezuela or Brazil, that we have, you know, gone on the warpath against their model and are, I mean, that's what I would say. We've actually actively suppressed that model, or did the model itself fail, or, you know, was it flawed?
You know, when we talk about something as contentious as public banks and finance, it's always a difficult topic. And I like to premise my discussion. You know, public banks, they're a necessary condition of the democratization of development and a necessary condition of an alternative to neoliberalism, but they're not sufficient in and of themselves. They're just one part of a puzzle. And when economies are going great, public banks can be part of that puzzle. And when they're not going so great, they may or may not be part of that puzzle as well, but they certainly can't be responsible for every good and every evil that happens in an economy, when it's thriving or not. And, you know, the same can be very much said about, you know, the question of Latin America. And they have a long tradition of public banks, et cetera, throughout the region, but also, you know, a long history of problems with democracy and democratization and coups and instability, and a long history with American incursions into the region in very undemocratic and oppressive ways. And to the extent that countries often try to pursue alternatives, they quite often get smashed or crushed or repressed in one way or another by northern bankers, American bankers, or governing forces who don't want anything to do with an alternative form of development that doesn't buy into the Washington consensus or to neoliberalism. And so, you know, as you find within the U.S. and with your own, you know, amazing and inspiring public banking movement, and it was quite modest attempts to break with Wall Street and break with the logic of private finance, that those efforts are crushed in different ways, or not necessarily crushed, but resisted, you know, quite strongly by the establishment, by Wall Street, by private interests. And, you know, nobody's talking yet in the U.S. of nationalizing, you know, the entire banking system. But they live in fear of that, and the private interests do, capital, financial capital. And the same can be said for much of the region in Latin America, that they're fearful of the positive examples that, that do exist or can exist. And when things go wrong, then they obviously make the most of it to substantiate their case that public banks do more harm than good. But the point is to democratize them. It isn't necessarily just because something is public that is necessarily good or will always be run well or run in the public interest. And so the struggle, both in U.S., and I think through much Latin America, I would say anywhere in the world where public bank is not run by representatives of the community, it's an important struggle to make that bank representative, to democratize it, and to build connections to your community and to deepen that sense of commitment to your community and to the public banks that you may already own by connecting it substantially, democratically to your community. And in doing that, you can also resist then both the trouble you can see of right-wing populism or overt American interventionism by, democratizing finance, banks, and the economy.
Yeah, one problem we have here is that the major media, of course, are owned. I mean, they're all largely connected with the banks. So We just don't have a voice. That we've got our minor media, we've got our alternative media where we have lots of voice. But for example, in Los Angeles, we had, it was just one article in the LA Times that was negative. And anytime you would Google LA Public Bank, that one would come up first because, that's where people go, the LA Times. So we didn't have a foot in the door there, but we are building nevertheless. I mean, the movement does keep growing. I'm quite impressed myself.
It is impressive. It's amazing. And I think going back to this notion that it's really necessary if you want to develop a more community-based form of development in the U.S. or abroad, and alternatives to this sort of hyper-neoliberalism, hyper-financialization, that you're able to connect to communities. And going back to the German example again, it's not just that they have this big, one big, for example, KfW development bank, but they also have many local regional development banks and the Sparkhausen. And so people understand, and there's been a long history of public banks being involved in people's communities and supporting them both through good and bad. And so it isn't necessarily in the case that media, whether it does or doesn't support them, it's that they're connected to people's lives. And that is sort of the important point, is to build it into and make it tradition. And that's sort of getting the banks off the ground and getting them mobilized and getting them working in the public interest. But the same could be said, in Turkey as well, that these public banks have persisted because there's a strong connection to communities. I mean, the first public bank in Turkey goes back to 1890s. Well, as a bank, agricultural bank, more than a century old. And it still persists today, because it's connected to communities, to farmers, and people realize the value of it, whether or not they can judge for themselves. You don't have to be told by the LA Times, for example. They know very well the role that bank plays in the community.
The Bank of North Dakota had its 100th year anniversary this year.
It's amazing.
The people know it's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that LA, these sorts of ridiculous right-wing populist arguments come out saying, because it's a public bank, it's corrupt and will never do any good for your community. People in North Dakota are probably going to laugh at that and say, well, really? Ours has been around for 100 years. It's done quite a bit of good. What are you talking about?
Can you tell people where to find your work and anything else you'd like to say about your work?
Sure. If you're interested in anything I've been saying or writing on this topic, you can go to my staff webpage at SOAS, S-O-A-S, University of London Development Studies. You can just Google Thomas Marwa, S-O-A-S, and look under my publications, and there's quite a bit of work there, and find a number of references there.
Okay. Well, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ellen. I appreciate it so much. And again, I just want to say thank you for your time, and honestly, the work you're doing in the U.S. is quite inspiration, I think, to many people in Europe and elsewhere. And they're very excited to see what's going on. And we wish you and the public banking movement and all its diversity the greatest of success in the future.
We'll hear more discussion about global public banks from Thomas Marwa and Ellen on our next edition of It's Our Money. Now we return to our series of historical stories about the beginnings and issues related to the start of the Bank of North Dakota, the United States' only public bank so far, now 100 years old. Just as the public banking advocates of today face off against a variety of challenges to bring forward a new approach to civic banking, the founders of the Bank of North Dakota had their own set of difficulties, some of them very similar to those of today in the form of pushback from the banking industry. Our host for this series is the author of the BND Centenary book and an expert on North Dakota history, Mike Jacobs. The book is called The Bank of North Dakota, The First 100 Years, and today we pick up in the period after the bank's official founding. That's when the real trouble started.
I think that the critical issue for the bank at the beginning was to reassure private banking interests within the state and also local political subdivisions, which were being compelled to deposit their collections with the Bank of North Dakota, which was something completely new to them, of course. And so the initial management of the bank, skipping ahead of the bit of nastiness at the very beginning when there were difficulties, you know, between the members of the banking board, the Industrial Commission. Once that had gotten past, I think that the manager of the bank, F.W. Catherall, who had been in the banking business, I think his big concern was that he reassure bankers in the state that he could be trusted and the bank could be trusted as a respondent bank, for one thing, but beyond that, with the tax money, the local collections that had very likely been deposited in local banks. That was a particular concern of opponents of the central bank, the state bank, was that they were losing the deposits from local subdivisions. In some cases, those probably would have been, almost certainly were, their largest source of ready cash. Early on, Catherall issued what he called a declaration of faith. You know, you can trust us. As we know, the 1920s were a period of contraction in the banking business, particularly in the Great Plains states, and so there was a great deal of pressure on banks on the Northern Plains, at least, because of the sharp decline in commodity prices at the end of World War I. And the almost complete cessation of infrastructure building. The railroad network had been laid out, so there wasn't, you know, that wasn't happening anymore. That wasn't bringing in workers and their cash. Coincidentally, the state embarked on a fairly extensive Get North Dakota Out of the Mud campaign to build a state highway system at about the same time. So, you know, the context here is that the state bank was pulling in deposits at the same time that private capital was no longer available to rural banks especially. And so the initial management of the bank worked hard to reassure voters as well as bankers that they needed to reassure people that they were going to be able to operate as a bank and that their money would be safe. There was a very strong reaction, of course, among private bankers against the Bank of North Dakota, and it was an important part of the recall campaign of the League leadership, the League Industrial Commission that managed the bank and the other state enterprises. Although opponents of the League convinced North Dakotans that they should get rid of the Industrial Commission, voters retained the bank and the mill and elevator and the other state-owned enterprises that the League had created. So the regular Republicans, as they were called, the Independent Voters Association, there were a whole bunch of names, there were a whole bunch of different groups that came together, really was faced with having to operate the bank despite not being enthusiastic about the idea of state banking. The bank opened as a captive depository, so the state's revenues, the state agencies, tax collections and the like, fees and all that were deposited in the bank. So it had a source of capital. The amount of money coming from subdivisions would have been relatively smaller, although the major cities at the time, you know, they were collecting substantial amounts of tax revenue in the context of the times, of course. Wouldn't Right. seem like much now. The other problem, though, was that part of the campaign against the bank was to create uncertainty about the security of state-issued bonds. Of course, governments at all levels use bonds to raise capital and then repay it over the course of tax collections and the like. So there was a campaign against essentially questioning the security of state-issued bonds, bonds issued by the state of North Dakota. And that caused a real crisis for the bank, and league leaders undertook a nationwide bond-selling campaign to try to relieve the anxiety about the value of bonds. They weren't entirely successful in that, and that was one of the reasons that the opposition to the bank was successful in the campaign to recall the league leadership. But once the bank was saved in that October 1921 election, when it had, its existence had been put on the ballot, and the no vote won, people said, no, we're not going to repeal the charter of the bank. So that the incoming administration, headed by the new governor, Nestos, was essentially compelled to, or chose to at least, continue the bank. And Nestos actually went to money centers, Minneapolis especially, and New York especially, in order to calm the fears of people who might be interested in buying bonds. At the same time, of course, the ambitions of the bank were turned back considerably in the 20s. Part of that was ideological, and part of it was just a reaction to the quite sharp contraction in the economy that occurred in agricultural areas of the United States well before the collapse of the economy that brought on the Depression. The archives are full of a correspondence from potential investors questioning the security of their investment in the bank, and then replies, particularly from William Lemke, who was the Attorney General and the principal defender of the bank on the national level, did a lot of traveling on behalf of bond sales. And there was a strong effort to shore up the bank by sales of bonds to labor unions, sympathetic political organizations, and the like. But as is often the case, of course, there aren't enough of those to match the animosity toward the state bank that was being generated by private bankers, and particularly by Twin Cities banks that had long been doing business both as originating loans and essentially buying up the credit that was helping to build the state. The slowdown in infrastructure really exacerbated the problem. Not vastly different than what happens in emerging economies in the third world that are attempting to establish a secure credit rating.
Now, and you point out that the Minneapolis banks even refused to clear their checks.
Yes, and checks for truly almost insignificant amounts were returned. I don't have the book in front of me, but there's one that's cited there of a check for a dollar and something. You know, even in 1921 or 22, you know, any bank would have been able to cover that check, I would think. So my point is that there was a conscious effort to undermine the bank that was not limited to private bankers in the state. It came up in the banking system elsewhere, and I mean, there are a great many letters of inquiry about the security of North Dakota bonds in the Lemke files at the University of North Dakota. Lemke kept everything, or at least somebody who worked for Lemke kept everything. And so there are literally hundreds of inquiries from people who had sympathetic people who had invested, you know, in many cases, quite trivial amounts in the state bank, and then reassurances coming from Lemke that it was going to turn out okay, you know, which did actually happen, although it took a good deal of time and effort.
You mentioned the ideological conflict underlying all of this.
We have to remember that in 1919, almost simultaneous with the passage of the Bank of North Dakota bill and the establishment of the bank in late February of 1919, in early March, a man named A. Mitchell Palmer was appointed Attorney General of the United States by President Woodrow Wilson. And Palmer launched, the Red Scare of 1919. And the bank and the public ownership program in North Dakota was a target, partly because it was seen as Bolshevik by people promoting that notion, but also because the League was very suspicious about the motives for the First World War and for U.S. entry into the First World War. But in the end, when all was said and done, there were more prosecutions under the Sedition Act per capita in North Dakota than in any other state. And so this sort of Red Scare undermined the confidence of even of sympathetic people to the Bank of North Dakota.
Even that sounds similar to the type of mischaracterization that public banking is receiving these days in the United States. The Red Scare of socialism is being used to deter serious consideration of an idea that sounds like it might be something that it isn't. Well, we'll continue this great unfolding story of the history of the Bank of North Dakota next time here on It's Our Money. Our thanks to Mike Jacobs for sharing these stories from his book, The Bank of North Dakota, The First 100 Years. You can find that book on the Bank of North Dakota website or at your local booksellers or on Amazon. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.